It is Monday, January 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Islamic State claims responsibility for the deadly Istanbul nightclub attack. The United States condemns North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's remarks on his nation's missile program, and we hear some music celebrating the new year. It's all ahead. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility Monday for a New Year's attack on a nightclub in Istanbul, Turkey, that left 39 people dead and authorities searching for a shooter who got away. The group said in a statement a soldier of the caliphate carried out the shooting. Turkey's deputy prime minister said authorities have obtained the fingerprints and basic description of the gunman and are close to identifying him. He also confirmed reports that 8 people have been detained in connection with the assault. I spoke with Charlie Winter, research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College London. I asked him about how IS has characterized this attack.
Based on the claim of responsibility that the Islamic State has produced, they are trying to brand it as something that has been centrally directed rather than an attack which is being carried out by a supporter who's perhaps spoken with individuals within the Islamic State and they've egged them on to carry out a stabbing attack or something like that. In this instance, the Islamic State is saying, we ordered this, one of our operatives carried this out, and it is something which was orchestrated from within Syria or Iraq. So that matters because it points towards a logistics network, it points towards much more complicated planning, and I think it's all geared towards potentially representing a sea change in the Islamic State's agitation in Turkey. This is a point which it's trying to make through this attack. It's saying the years where we've been kind of having a fairly ambiguous presence in your country are over, and now the war is being brought to you. And this is something which has come through a lot in the Islamic State's propaganda over the last few months.
Why Turkey?
Why Turkey? Well, I mean, there are a load of reasons, really, but one of the key ones right now is the fact that the Turkish army is involved in northern Syria and actually making serious headway against the Islamic State in what has been a very, very important province or area that's been under its control for a number of years now. So Aleppo province is shrinking by the day, and that is having a profound impact upon the Islamic State organization and its insurgency in Syria, and with a knock-on effect in Iraq as well. So what the Islamic State needs to do is show that it is still a potent force and show that there is no encroachment on its territory without retribution. So this is an attack where it's trying to say, look, we're still in the game, and no matter how much land you take away from us in northern Syria, we will fight back. But as well as that, it's of course trying to just get into the headlines on its own terms. This is propaganda of the deed. It's propaganda which is essentially aiming to draw attention to the Islamic State cause, but point towards a consistent level of momentum and sustain this idea of triumphalism, that the Islamic State is moving forward, that it is more threatening than ever, and that it is still a viable jihadist organization. It's always thinking about what its audiences think of it. And we have to think of its terrorism as an extension of its propaganda in that sense.
And apparently in this statement that Islamic State issued, it says that this attack was made in response to an order of, I believe he's called the Emir, who is its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Yes, so the statement does specifically say that the attack was carried out in accordance with or in response to an order from Amir al-Mu'mineen, so the Prince of the Believers, which is another title given to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State. And, I mean, I think, yes, that's clear that they're trying to draw a direct line between the Islamic State organization and the attacker. But I think we can also take that with a bit of a pinch of salt. I don't think that there was actually a direct order given. You could interpret that as just saying the individual who carried out the attack listened to a speech made by Baghdadi a couple of months ago, and then he carried out the attack in response to what Baghdadi said within those lines. But what's interesting is that it doesn't adopt the usual language that the Islamic State has used for attacks which have come to be spoken of as either inspired or virtually planned, depending on which way you see it. So the stabbing attacks, the lorry attacks, most recently Berlin, of course, these were carried out by individuals who, according to the Islamic State, perpetrated the attack in response to various calls by the Islamic State to take retributive justice against the nations that are attacking it. Now, that wasn't the case with this attack. This attack was claimed, and the claim was rhetorically shrouded within this idea that it was about retribution, about vengeance, about attacking specifically Turkey because of its role in the war against the Islamic State. It was really trying to make as direct a line between the attacker and the organization as possible. And I think the reference to Baghdadi is important, but I don't think that's the key thing. I think the key thing is how they actually spoke about the target itself.
Charlie Winter, Research Fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College London. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending in this new year?
Well, let's look back at the old year very briefly. 2016, many people said, was the worst year ever for a number of different reasons. And just before midnight here on the east coast of the United States, we saw what many on social media said was a fitting way to end such an horrible year. And that was a performance by Mariah Carey in Times Square in New York, where she was lip-syncing and just bungled the performance. She didn't sing at certain points, said she couldn't hear. She was having audio issues. And so people saying that this kind of train wreck of a performance was the cap on another kind of terrible year. Mariah Carey, for her credit, tweeted out, blank happens, blank, using an expletive there. So taking it all in stride, but now has come out and her people are saying, alleging sabotage. So we'll see how that plays out into 2017, if she wants to kind of let that be and start the new year fresh, or if she's going to pursue that. But a big topic of conversation as the clock struck midnight here in the U.S. on New Year's Eve into New Year's Day. And for those of us out there looking for a New Year's resolution, I have one that may be fitting. Less time on Facebook. And that's because of these two studies that have come out, one from the University of Copenhagen. It looked at 1,000 Danish Facebook users and found that less time on Facebook resulted in increasing life satisfaction and more positive emotions. They said even a week off of Facebook could help with that. That was because people, when you're on Facebook, you see a lot of happy pictures and family and gifts, especially around the holidays, and it can make people feel depressed and bad about themselves. The other reason is a bit more serious. ProPublica did a study where they looked at how Facebook obtains data. And apparently Facebook is buying data about its users from outside third-party vendors, everything from household income to number of credit cards a user has to even race information, which they allege could be used to discriminate. So that might be another reason to get off the social media networks for a little while, to be careful about what data they're using and how they're using it.
Might be time just to read a good book.
It might be. That's a good resolution for 2017.
All right. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. President Barack Obama sets his farewell speech next week in his hometown of Chicago. 60 are killed in a prison riot in Brazil. Indian politicians are barred from using religion or caste in campaigns. And suicide blast killed 7 people in Mogadishu. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests random temperature fluctuations in Earth's surface and within its mantle could have kickstarted our planet's moving plate tectonic system rather than being predetermined during its formation. Research based on new mathematical modeling proposes that these unique plate tectonics may be the reason why Earth is habitable, unlike the 3 other terrestrial planets of our solar system. Study co-author Matthew Weller, a geologist at the University of Texas at Austin, says that the new findings could change how scientists understand how planets and perhaps life itself can evolve. He says modeling planetary evolution may help scientists not only understand our own solar system, but Earth-like extrasolar planets as well. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear some New Year's music. The United States has called on North Korea to avoid provocative and inflammatory actions and words that threaten international peace and stability after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that test launch preparation for an intercontinental ballistic missile is in its last stage. Mr. Kim's remarks came in an annual televised New Year's Day address. But RAND Corporation security analyst Bruce Bennett tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Mr. Kim is getting ahead of the real state of North Korea's missile program.
The missile before the ICBM is the Musudong missile, which has much less range. And in 2016, he tested it 8 times. It failed 7 of the 8. So I think North Korea's still got some problems with their design of ballistic missiles that they've got to sort out. But they might sort it out early in 2017. We really don't know. So Kim Jong-un is obviously anxious to move ahead with an ICBM test.
Is the Musudong a threat to U.S. territory?
To Guam, it certainly is, and to U.S. military bases in Japan or Korea. It could be used there as well.
Of course, 2016 was a very missile-rich time for North Korea.
Oh, absolutely. Over 35 ballistic missile tests, if you count all of the ballistic missiles they tested. Yeah, it was very rich.
What does this tell you about the status of their program?
First of all, they've made good progress on their Scud and Nodong, the shorter-range missiles, the missiles up to about 1,500-kilometer range. Those seem to be proving to be pretty reliable, but they're still struggling with the longer-range missiles. That said, it's a program making progress, so I think the U.S. needs to take a very hard line against it.
Bruce, a U.S. State Department spokeswoman on Sunday called on the North to refrain from provocative actions and inflammatory rhetoric that threatened international peace and stability. She went on to say that all states must use every available channel and means of influence to make clear to the DPRK and its enablers that launches using ballistic missile technology are unacceptable, and there was a call for return to talks. What do you think?
I don't think that's any different from what we've heard in the past. I think if that's the position we take, North Korea is going to proceed right on. I think we need to take a harder position.
What impact have sanctions had? North Korea has been under some form of sanctions since 2006.
The problem with sanctions is that sanctions depend upon trade. And most of North Korea's trade, 95% or so of its trade, is with China. And China does not generally implement the sanctions. It usually chooses not to because the sanctions would hurt Chinese economy in the Northeast, which is the poorest part of China. So China's got economic incentives not to do it, but it also has some political incentives not to. It's not particularly happy with the U.S. right now, and so it's not going to probably do anything serious.
That's Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation. He said the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump has a range of options to deal with future tests, including what he calls the extreme measure of attempting to shoot down a missile, depriving Pyongyang of valuable information. He said that could force the North back to the negotiating table. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Thank you. This is International Edition. Well, we hope your new year is off to a great start. As we sent 2016 into the history books, International Edition Steve Norman shared some of the music from the traditional to the avant-garde that many of us like to listen to this time of the year. On New Year's Eve, yeah, 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 yeah. I do believe on New
And not a second later, she stay in the mix like a crossfader. It's about to go down, no elevator. Live for the moment, love in the air. She got me feeling like I don't wanna be a player. Real talk, so I don't wanna be unfair. Now watch the apple drop and celebrate the year. Yeah, I see you shining way from over there. And all the
Snoop Dogg is an American rapper and actor, and he's been a mainstay on the music scene for 25 years. Also heard on this cut of Snoop's New Year's Eve is singer-songwriter Marty James. Going a little more traditional with Frank Lesser's What Are You Doing New Year's Eve, which hit the top of the charts for the group The Orioles in 1949, contemporary artist A.J. Raphael and Tori Kelly do the honors.
Hey.
So, what are you doing for New Year's and stuff?
Actually, I don't really know yet. What about you?
Oh, yeah, I don't really know what I'm doing yet either.
Well, I just kind of wanted to ask. Maybe it's much too early in the game. But I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing New Year's Eve?
Wonder whose arms will hold you good and tight when it's exactly 12 o'clock at night. Welcoming in the
rocker Bruce Springsteen doing the countdown to New Year's in 2009, and other rockers like the Eagles and U2 wrote original songs about New Year's.
Last night I was a happy man, look the way I feel right now. It's gonna be a
And then there's nothing like the New Year's favorite Auld Lang Syne, credited to the works of Scotland's poet Robert Burns, and sung here by American superstars of rhythm and blues, Aretha Franklin and Billy Preston, on Billy's 1987 TV show from Detroit.
Acquaintance be forgot, and days of old.
Oh,
That is the music of Aretha Franklin and Billy Preston. And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us and have a happy new year.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in the 35 years since a terrible new disease, known today as HIV/AIDS, was identified. Before, an HIV/AIDS diagnosis was a death sentence. A person with HIV often lived less than a year after it progressed to AIDS. Today, nearly half of the 37 million people living with HIV/AIDS receive life-saving HIV treatment, allowing them normal lives. Through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the United States has been at the forefront of the global response. PEPFAR is the largest commitment by any nation to combat a single disease in history, said U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Ambassador Deborah Birx. Recent data show the epidemic is becoming controlled in several key African countries, demonstrating the remarkable impact of PEPFAR's investments. Indeed, achieving an AIDS-free generation is now within our reach. Driven by research and data, our collective efforts have saved millions of lives and are turning the tide against HIV/AIDS, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. Today, PEPFAR is supporting 11.5 million people globally with life-saving treatment. The good news is, according to a recent UNAIDS report, infections in children globally have dropped 51% between 2010 and 2015. Simultaneously, annual AIDS-related deaths fell from 2 to 1.11 million. The bad news is the virus is spreading among young women in sub-Saharan Africa. According to a recent UNAIDS report, last year nearly 1 in 5 new infections worldwide occurred in women between the ages of 15 and 24. Adolescent girls and young women account for nearly 75% of new HIV infections among adolescents in sub-Saharan Africa. This is concerning, as the 15 to 24-year-old population in sub-Saharan Africa will have doubled by 2020. There are many reasons for the alarming rates of new HIV infections among young women, including gender-based violence, exclusion from economic opportunities, insufficient access to health care, even a lack of access to secondary education. So, through PEPFAR, the United States is working with its partners to reduce, by the end of 2017, new HIV infections among adolescent girls and young women by 40% in the highest HIV burden areas of 10 sub-Saharan African countries. It's the first time the U.S. government has ever set specific targets for preventing new HIV infections among this group, underscoring the U.S. global strategy to empower adolescent girls. With our partners, we can sustain an enduring legacy of American leadership, compassion, and determination, said USAID Administrator Smith. Together, we can end AIDS worldwide by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.